Amen. Boy, that's one of those ones where the news media says relevant. That's relevant. That has some significance today, and it's certainly going to have some significance in the future as well. I appreciate that. Well, technically, our lesson this morning is Haggai chapter 1, but we didn't finish up with Ezra chapter 4, and because there's such a tie-in between Haggai and Ezra, we're going to finish up that chapter and then jump into a real lesson for this week. And I think it's going to work out all right because next week will be Haggai 2. And if I just happen to not quite finish chapter 1, I think we can get it all taken care of by next week. But anyway, it's kind of interesting with the hurricane and everything. I heard from two different sources this week. People talking about what a wicked city, you know, and of course everybody knows New Orleans is famous for Mardi Gras, but they're also famous for another horrible festival, and they call it the Southern Degeneracy Festival. And somebody was telling me that they knew somebody that had just gone to New Orleans for a conference, and it just happened to be that this thing was going on, and they said just unspeakable things were going on in the streets of that city. It just happens that this was the week that they were supposed to have that festival. I don't guess they'll be having it this week. Praise God for that. But anyway, as it was in the days of Lot, that's where we're living. That's the kind of mess that's going on today. But anyway, Ezra chapter 4. Let's read verses 7 through 10 here. And in the days of Artaxerxes wrote Bishlam, Mithredath, Tabeel, and the rest of their companions unto Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And the writing of the letter was written in the Syrian tongue and interpreted in the Syrian tongue. Rehum the chancellor and Shimshai the scribe wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes the king in this sort. Then wrote Rehum the chancellor and Shimshai the scribe and the rest of their companions, the Dinaites and the some of these names. You look at those things, get down to the Archivites, the Babylonians, and so forth, down to the end. That's the companions, see, all the nationalities connected to these people, these enemies. Then verse 10, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Asnapar brought over and set in the cities of Samaria, and the rest that are on this side of the river, and at such a time. All right, these adversaries are those heathen folks that the king of Assyria brought in to fill the vacuum. When the king of Assyria came into the northern kingdom, those 10 tribes up north, they came in and hauled those people captive. And they knew there was going to be problems, so what he did was he brought some outsiders in to fill that vacuum. And that's the bunch right here that are working against the the nation of Judah, really. And so that's what they're facing here. There are a bunch of pagan Gentiles who benefited from the captivity of that northern kingdom. And you know something, when a Gentile complains to another Gentile about a Jew, who do you think that Gentile is going to believe? It always happens, you know. And so that's what's going on. He'll side with his own kind about 99% of the time. And so it is with Artaxerxes here. He's getting a letter of complaint from these people against the Jews. And he's going to side with these troublemakers. And we should note that one of these troublemakers who writes this letter to King Artaxerxes is a scribe. He's a scribe. Now in the Bible, there's some good scribes. There's some pretty lousy scribes. Now Jesus Christ had his battles with the scribes of his day. Those folks weren't good folks. They were always trying to mess him up. But you know what? Ezra was a scribe. Ezra in chapter 7, verse 6, it says about him that he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses. That guy's a good scribe. But this character right here, who's writing a letter against God's people,
as something different. Today, we'd call him a reporter. We'd call him a journalist. And we'd say he's objective. You know. He's just reporting. You know, that's what it is. And this newspaper reporter, what he's writing is something against Jerusalem. That's what it says there. It says that what they wrote, that this letter here was against Jerusalem, and it's against the city of peace. You know what they're doing? They're stirring up trouble. They're trying to get rid of the peace. And of course, this is the kind of journalism that starts wars, starts trouble. And boy, that stuff is just rampant in America. In fact, they say, and I don't doubt it one bit, that the way you climb the ladder of success in journalism is you ruin somebody or you start some trouble. And the more trouble you start, the better, you know, the bigger name you get, all that stuff. That's the kind of devilment the American news media is guilty of, and that's what these folks are up to. Let's look at verses 11 through 16. Of course, we could say much, much more about those these other verses, but verse 11 says, "This is the copy of the letter that they sent unto him, even unto Artaxerxes the king. Thy servants, the men on this side the river, and at such a time, be it known unto the king that the Jews, which came up from thee to us, are come unto Jerusalem, building the rebellious and the bad city, and have set up the walls thereof, and joined the foundations. Be it known now unto the king, that if this city be builded, and the walls set up again, then will they not pay toll, tribute, and custom, and so thou shalt endamage the revenue of the kings. Now because we have maintenance from the king's palace, and it was not meet for us to see the king's dishonor, therefore have we sent and certified the king, that search may be made in the book of the records of thy fathers. So shalt thou find in the book of the records, and know that this city is a rebellious city, and hurtful unto kings and provinces, and that they have moved sedition within the same of old time. For which cause was this city destroyed? We certify the king that if this city be builded again, and the walls thereof set up, by this means thou shalt have no portion on this side the river." All right. In this passage, you know, we get to look over the shoulder of these reporters, these folks who are drafting a letter against God's people, a letter sent to King Artaxerxes. And all the, again, the purpose of that whole thing is to cause trouble for God's people. Today, this same bunch would be writing to Kofi Annan, you know, the leader of the United Nations. They know where to go to get attention and to cause trouble. And the same bunch are writing letters to the United Nations about those bad Jews who are, you know, killing us after we sent suicide bombers into them, you know. You know, nothing has changed. We're living in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. The same thing that happened back then is happening today. That's strange, isn't it? We think we're so advanced, so sophisticated, so educated, we're beyond these ancient civilizations, and the same stuff that went on then is going on today. Speaking of advanced civilizations and education and so forth, it's amazing what's going on in New Orleans, or what went on this week, right? In an advanced, educated society, you know. What a mess. Now, verse 13, that's an interesting number. You get the very crux of the letter right there in verse 13. And the thing is, the crux of this whole thing is that the Jews will rebel. As soon as they get things built up, they are going to rebel. And you know that's what they're saying, because in verse 12 and again in verse 15, the word rebellious is used. It's rebellious Jews, you know. And so they're accusing them of rebellion before anything ever happened. And of course, they have no intentions of rebelling. And yet that's what they're falsely accused of. And of course, the way they frame this thing is that they are going to rebel in the form of a tax revolt, and money is going to be, going to be the effect of the thing. Artaxerxes, you're going to lose a lot of tax money if you let these people continue to build. They know which buttons to push, don't they? They really do. They know exactly how to paint good people in the worst possible light, and that's exactly the goal and purpose of the mainstream news media. Now the letter ends by saying that if the king allows the Jews to rebuild the city, he won't have anything left in the West Bank. In verse 16, right there. Well, let's read verses 17 through the end of the chapter. Then sent the king an answer unto Rehum the chancellor, and to Shimshai the scribe, and to the rest of their companions that dwell in Samaria, and unto the rest beyond the city, peace. And at such a time, the letter which ye sent unto us hath been plainly read before me. And I commanded, and search hath been made, and it is found that this city of old time hath made insurrection against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been made therein. There have been mighty kings also over Jerusalem, which have ruled over all countries beyond the river, and toll, tribute, and custom was paid unto them. Give ye now commandment to cause these men to cease, and that this city be not builded, until another commandment shall be given for me. Take heed now that ye fail not to do this. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the kings? Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews, and made them to cease by force and power. Then ceased the work of the house of God which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Well, Artaxerxes orders a historical study of the nation of Israel, and he finds that some of what the letter had said was true. There were some great kings, you know, David and Solomon and so forth, ruling over the nation. You know, these people always have a little bit of truth mixed in. And because of that, it makes their lies more believable, because they do that. And so he found that, at least a portion of that thing was true. And, this combined with the scare tactics used in the letter causes the king to order a work stoppage for the temple. Cause it to stop until you hear from me again. That was his order. Well, don't you know that these rats, these adversaries of the Jews, rejoiced all the way to Jerusalem. As soon as they got their response, it says they went in haste. Man. You know, the king didn't have to tell them. You make sure you tell them. Man, they were more than happy to tell the Jews to quit building the house of God. And so they they make a haste to get there. And in verse 24, the work on the house of the Lord stops, and it doesn't start again for another 15 years. And it just stops. The whole thing, you know, comes to a standstill. At this point, we're going to move to the book of Haggai. And I'll tell you why we're going there. Look at Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1. Then the prophets, Haggai the prophet, and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. So at the end of chapter 4, the work stops. And there's a gap in time. And what you have here is Zechariah and Haggai prophesying to the people that are there. And so we're going to study what Haggai had to say. And what he has to say basically is, let's get back to the work God called us to do in the first place. And so it's because of the preaching or the prophesying of these prophets that God's people gets back to doing what God had called them to do. So let's turn over to Haggai chapter 1. And just by way of introduction to this book, there's two chapters. I mean, it's a really short book. Two chapters. There's 38 verses, and I feel pretty confident about those two numbers. The next one, not so confident, but, you know, since it's a short book, it's probably pretty good. 1,131 words in the book of Haggai. And obviously, Haggai is the author. He's a prophet of God, and he's called the Lord's messenger. He's not delivering a message to the Lord. He's delivering a message from the Lord to somebody. And we'll see that in a little bit. And again, his purpose is to get God's people back doing what they were supposed to do. That was to build the temple of God. Now, this thing, as far as chronology is concerned, it was written or prophesied during the work stoppage. See, the time in between here, these about 15 years where nothing is happening, nothing's going on, that's when Haggai is doing his work, and that's when the book was written, or at least prophesied. The key word in this book is the word consider. God says it four times for his people to consider something. Consider. Think about what's happening. That's a pretty good word for today. Consider. Well, if Americans would just consider some things, they might, you know, it might be a profitable experience, but they're not going to consider the truth. And the key phrase is the Lord of hosts. That thing has 14 letters in it, the Lord of hosts. And it occurs 14 times in the book of Haggai. That's a lot. When you consider only 38 verses, 14 times. It occurs 14 times, but it occurs in 12 verses. So it doubled up on several occasions. And of course, 12 is the number of Israel. So it's a good connection there. Well, let's read the first 11 verses here. Haggai chapter 1. In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Josedech, the high priest, saying, Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, This people say, The time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, Consider your ways. Ye have sown much, and bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build a house, that I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith the Lord. Ye looked for much, and lo, it came to little. And when ye brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why, saith the Lord of hosts, because of mine house that is waste, and ye run every man unto his own house. Therefore the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from her fruit. And I called for a drought upon the land, and upon the mountains, and upon the corn, and upon the new wine, and upon the oil, and upon that which the ground bringeth forth, and upon men, and upon cattle, and upon all the labor of the hands. Well, Ezra chapter 4, 25, which we just read earlier, the work stoppage ends in the second year of Darius's reign, and Haggai gives his prophecy in that very same year. So what's happening is he's prophesying and they're responding, see, to Haggai's message. And he gets them back on track. We should note a very, very significant and relevant truth in verse 1. There was a Jewish government in Palestine after the captivity. Everybody knows there was a government in Palestine, you know, David's ruling, Solomon's ruling. by the way, that thing goes all the way back to Joshua. He brings them in, and he's ruling the nation. And you got all those judges ruling and everything else. There was governments set up there, and there's a government after the captivity. Why is that significant? Why is that important? Well, you know what the news media calls Palestinians? They call them Palestinians. Those Palestinians descended from people who never had a government in Palestine bigger than a city-state. They ran little cities, you know. They never did have control over large blocks of land within Palestine at all. Not once. They never governed the Gaza Strip. They never governed the West Bank. But the news media would have you believe that it's their land, it's been their land, and, you know, Israel's occupiers. That's that bunch that was writing the letter to Artaxerxes. Same bunch, stirring up trouble. You know what the United States is doing? Our great government? Trying to set up two states in Palestine. Never was two states there. One of those states has as its stated goal and desire to annihilate God's people. And we want to be a part of that? Should we be surprised that we're having trouble? By the way, President Bush on August 23rd in a news conference said, quote, "This is a very hopeful period. Again, I applaud Prime Minister Sharon for making a decision that has really changed the dynamics on the ground and has really provided hope for the Palestinian people. My vision, my hope, is that one day we'll see two states, two democratic states living side by side in peace." That gets you in trouble every time. That's working against God and His desire. Well, at that time, there was a storm brewing in the Caribbean. Shortly after he finished, that little tropical depression turned into a hurricane and clipped the southern part of Florida and killed, I don't know, 5-6 people, something like that. Folks said, well, you know, that's not too bad. Got into the Gulf, and man, that thing really got whipped up. That thing was Category 5, and they said if they had anything higher than Category 5, it would have been that higher amount. I mean, that thing was something else. And of course, when it came to shore, it was a Category 4. Early estimates of that thing were $25 billion worth of damage. I don't know, might be higher than that. The question is, when are we going to pay attention to Genesis chapter 12? Consider. They're not going to consider. They're just going to keep their attention on the refugees and the problems there and providing food and shelter and not even consider the fact that the reason this happened was how we're treating Israel. So they're going to continue to mistreat Israel, and they're going to continue to say, get out of, you know, this land that we believe belonged to the Palestinians, and we're going to continue to have trouble, and we're going to have more evacuations. Speaking of that, there's at least five, there's probably a dozen similarities between the Gaza withdrawal and what happened here this past week. For example, the roadmap to peace brought a forced evacuation of Jewish settlements in Gaza. They didn't have a choice. Send the troops in and move them out. And so Hurricane Katrina, brought in a forced evacuation of New Orleans. No choice in the matter. You're leaving. The point of a gun, you're getting out. The Gaza withdrawal brought political difficulties for Ariel Sharon. You know, get all these images of Jewish settlers, been living there for 40 years, you know, being forced out. Can't help your political career. You got supporters and your coalition government resigning over the whole thing. Political trouble for Ariel Sharon. So President Bush is getting in trouble. He's getting accused of, you know, not reacting soon enough, and why didn't they do something beforehand? They knew the trouble. He's getting political trouble because he caused political trouble for Israel. The Gaza withdrawal brought a removal of dead bodies from Jewish cemeteries in Gaza. They had to dig those bodies up that were buried there, haul them over and bury them in Jewish territory now, because they're going to give that over to the Palestinians. I guess you know that New Orleans is below sea level. You can't bury bodies in New Orleans. They're above ground. That thing floods, and they say those bodies are in the water system. They're floating around in there. I'm not talking about people who died in the hurricane. I'm talking about people who died beforehand. They're in there. See? Well, one of the things Israel did when they moved those people out was they shut off the water supply. Turned it off. And so, New Orleans and Biloxi and some of these places have no water, which is just, natural thing when you have these kinds of disasters, Israeli bulldozers demolished many of the houses in the Gaza settlement. I know they had to destroy the synagogues and all that stuff, And of course, Hurricane Katrina came in there and just leveled the thing, man. Just amazing, the destruction that thing. And we can trace it back. Like Pastor said on Wednesday night, that thing could have been connected to the judgment of God. I just mentioned the Southern Degeneracy Festival. Surely God was not pleased with that. And we know God's not pleased with mistreating His people. And could be one of those things, or both. Probably both. But anyway, it'd be a time for America to consider what's happening. Well, also in verse 1, we see a political leader, Zerubbabel, and a religious leader, Joshua. When dealing with the nation of Israel, we often see, this church-state situation. And of course, that's what Americans shy away from. We don't want to see church-state, but that's because of the abuses of the Roman Catholic Church. And the Roman Catholic Church is famous for desiring exactly that Old Testament Jewish setup. They have no business being involved in. And that's why they create the messes they create when they do that. Well, like any of the prophets of God, Haggai begins with a "Thus saith the Lord," or in this case, a "Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts." There are five cases in this short book where Haggai gives a "Thus saith, thus speaketh the Lord." And that's quite a number. Again, 38 verses. You got five of those verses right here in this book. "Thus saith the Lord, thus speaketh the Lord." Now, why do these people say it is not time to build the house of God? Why are they saying that? The Lord says, "You're saying it's not time." Well, they assumed, that'll get you in trouble, won't it? You ever make some assumptions? Didn't quite pan out right. They assumed that rough sailing wasn't a sign of the Lord's will. I mean, a decree comes down from Artaxerxes, the king. You have to stop your work. I guess we have to stop. Guess it's not time. We'll just quit. Well, God called you to do something. You better not quit. You better not quit in time of trouble. If God called you to do something. And God called these people to build the house of the Lord, and they stopped. And they said, it's just not time. I guess it's not time for us. I guess we'll just quit. If you've been saved any length of time, you understand that when you surrender, either totally or partially, to the Lord to do something and to obey Him, you know what follows? Trouble. It's not smooth sailing when you commit yourself to obey the Lord and do His will. That just goes hand in hand. It just points out the truth of the Bible and the existence of the devil, if there wasn't a devil, why would you have any trouble? surrendering to God and deciding to live right and do right. And of course, that's probably the first lesson that folks learn when they surrender to God and do His will. There's trouble connected to it. Well, the Lord is obviously displeased with His people over the fact that their houses were given priority over the Lord's house. In verse 4, you notice that word, the sealed houses, C-E-I-L-E-D. Of course, you know, the new versions. That's an archaic word. We don't use that word. Nobody knows what that word means. Here's a real tough explanation of this. It means a house with a ceiling. A sealed house is a house with a ceiling. Isn't that tremendous? Man, that's hard, isn't it? It's hard for people to understand definitions like that. I'm reading this guy's book. He's got 168 words in the King James Bible that he considers difficult, archaic, obsolete. About 20% of them are so easily explained that it's just ridiculous. And that same guy believes in going to the Greek and Hebrew and explaining words that English people don't understand. Sealed means has a ceiling. You know, outlandish. Well, today it means, you know, somebody crazy that does some, you know, crazy thing. Well, in the Bible, it just means somebody outside the land. Ooh, that's really hard. Nobody can understand that, you know. 5 seconds, you can explain it, and it'll be in your mind, you know. But no, we can't have that. We have to have a new version. That changes words, meanings, doctrines, and all that other stuff so folks can understand. So the Lord's upset because they have heat ceilings in their houses. And of course, ceilings, if you grew up in church, you remember seeing the flannel graphs and all that stuff of the houses, you know, the buildings, the flat roofs. That's a lot of what they had, you know, these flat roofs. So that'd be the last thing they would build, is those ceilings in those houses. And once the ceiling is in, it's complete. It's finished. But God's house isn't finished. There's no ceiling in it. And God says, how come you get to live in a sealed house? And my house is, you know, out there in the open. Well, in verse 5, the Lord advises His people that they need to consider their ways. It's a call to the nation, but it's also a call to the individuals. And, why do you live in sealed houses? Individuals. You as individuals, how come you live in sealed houses, but God's house isn't? But it's also a call to a nation, you know, to get to work and do what God called them to do. Every nation needs to consider her ways, but they don't. You know, they've swallowed this business that everything's relevant. No, it's not. There are some absolute truths out there, and you better see how you line up with those absolute truths. We also should consider our ways personally. I mean, if we want God to bless us, I mean, we have to look inside and say, do my ways line up with God's ways? Are we going the same direction? You know? Well, what if we're off just a little bit? Well, we might be off just a little bit, but the farther we go along, the farther off we are. And so the Lord says, consider your ways. Think about it. Where are you at as far as God's ways are concerned? There's a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. That's everything's relevant. That seems right, you know. It seems right to do that. Really? You better be careful. We should also note that this call for consideration is repeated again in verse 7. Twice here. I repeat, consider your ways. Now, why does God repeat things? He does that over and over again. He repeats something. Why does He do that? Well, Joseph said something very interesting to Pharaoh when he was interpreting the dream that Pharaoh had. I say dream, it's really dreams. He had a couple of dreams. But Joseph said that they're really the same dream. And here's what he said in Genesis 41:32. He said, "And for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass." So God doubles something up because He's established it. And He's telling these people, you've got trouble right now, and I'm the one that's behind it. So you better consider your ways. It's established. There can be no doubt about it. Verse 9 is interesting because it shows the impotence of the power of, or the lack of power, the impotence of positive thinking. You know, God's people were expecting great things. They were getting little in return. You know, Norman Vincent Peale, you know, the power of positive thinking. You know what that amounts to? Nothing. When you're looking at man and man's accomplishments and man's abilities, ain't nothing to it. Man can think beautiful thoughts and everything just be a total disaster. What are you going to do down there in New Orleans? Think beautiful thoughts? And I'm beautiful about that whole mess. You know? And God says, consider that thing. And verses 4 through 9, you know, just a beautiful application. And it applies primarily to Jewish people who put their own houses and their home improvement projects ahead of the Lord and ahead of God's temple. It's a recipe for financial ruin. Or at least, you know, at the very least, you know, the rat race phenomenon, you know. You just get on the little wheel and you run and run and run and you never get anywhere. You just get a lot of exercise. And what does the Lord say? Bodily exercise profits a little, you know. And you're just running and running and not getting anywhere. Well, that comes from investing in the wrong things. God says you need to invest in the work of God. Get to work and do something. That kind of investment lasts. You know, no thief can break in and steal. No, you know, moth and corrupt and rust and all that business. It lasts. You know, if you leave the Lord out of your financial budget, you're just going to be spending a lot of money on things you wouldn't ordinarily spend on. You know, doctor bills, cars breaking down, all kinds of things. And I know we all have problems with it, and a lot of folks who, you know, have their finances and right have problems. But you'd have a lot more, you know, of those things if you didn't have those things in the proper place. Yeah, I don't know how. I'm sure most of you are the same. Well, I don't know how my budget lines. It really doesn't work too well on paper, you know. But somehow it works out. I don't know. You tell people, I give 10%, I give 15%, or whatever you give. You know, people think you're crazy. We got into a discussion at work one time. My boss said, these religious fanatics who give 10% to their church, you know. Who in the world would be that stupid? They look at you like you're nuts. You know, how in the world can you make ends meet? I don't know how you make ends meet. It just works, you know. And that's what God has to say about that. We'll have to stop right there and pick it up next time.